Welcome back to Fly Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast that can be both dead and pregnant and not dead and not pregnant all at the same time. I'm Nathan.
I'm pregnant.
I'm not pregnant.
And I am or am not the wife you've been looking for this season.
Well, 3 months ago we attended the Doctor's funeral and a week ago we were guests at his wedding. In the meantime, we've met Richard Nixon, some pirates, the Doctor's wife, twice, belligerent goo people, a scary turf, Hitler, a time-travelling, shape-shifting robot operated by miniaturised cross people, dollies, malfunctioning medical technology, twice, a sexy minotaur, and James Corden. Can we make any sense of all of this? Let's find out in our Series 6 retrospective.
Sexy Minotaur James Corden.
Yeah, that's an edit. That's not going to happen.
Thanks, Nathan. We always start with the hard-hitting questions here. So here we go. Snog, marry, avoid. Peter.
Peter.
Elsie, Jen, Gibbous. Well, you couldn't snog Elsie because her hips would give way. Gibbous, you could just put him in the closet and he'd look scared. That would be fine. And who's the other one? Jen.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not Rory, is it? I would avoid her at all costs, as I would the gangers. Okay, thank
it's
you.
A dry date, that one.
Alrighty. So one of our listeners, the human palindrome at Mark Cockrum, asks this. Can you ever have too much of Alex Kingston?
I'm going to say no. I have to say that there is something about the episodes that she's in, and it's not just her performance. It is also just the fact that the Doctor has a friend who's a recurring character.
A returning meme.
Yeah, and who works really well with the other regular cast, I think. I think about the Angels two-parter from last year. So much of that was about her relationship with the Doctor and her relationship with Amy. And having her back over and over again for the ARC episodes this year is just great, I think.
That is such a good point. Would young Matt have hit his stride so well if it weren't for Alex Kingston in that opening story, really showing him tone?
Yeah.
Because actors, for actors, it's the feel of the piece. It's the feel in the space of the piece, is it not? You've both acted, so.
Yeah, I mean, people play off one another and respond to one another.
Yeah, and raising the tone to a sassy screwball 30s Preston Sturges comedy type thing, which, you know, Kingston is a fan of and so is our lovely Stephen. I think you can have far too much of Riversong, but that which elevates Riversong is Alex Kingston.
Mm. I think what you're saying about Time of Angels, just to go back to last season, is correct because she was there in Matt and Karen's very first scenes on the beach, and I think they kind of imprinted on her, and she was a really valuable presence.
Rubbing the oil of performance. Amelioration into each other, yes. Go on.
And I think every time she turns up this season, you kind of cheer at the screen. Yeah. And so when she fires the gun and knocks the Stetson off the Doctor's head, you know it's going to be her before you see her, and it's just amazing. You're looking forward to it. The only time I think you can get maybe a little bit too much of River is in Let's Kill Hitler, which is an otherwise interesting episode, but I think it asks a little bit too much of her charisma in the same way as it does of Matt's. And so that's the only point where I find her presence a little bit wearing, but she's phenomenal.
Mm. And the actors had to work real hard in that one to get the charm factors up, didn't they? Because there was not a lot of charm happening.
Yeah,
there was a lot of quirk.
A lot of interest, yeah, yeah. But, yeah, tonally.
Yes, I do agree on that point. I've been listening to you guys talk about those episodes, which I was not in, and it was really interesting listening to you, Nathan, and your points of view on Let's Kill Hitler, and certainly Alex's performance in that, as she performs as Mel's. Mm. And for me, it's always slightly off-putting. Like, it doesn't feel like River Song.
Yeah.
And I struggle with the whole Mel's concept anyway. Again, you put forward a really good sort of defense about how we, well, a defense, a point of view, like we drop into the Amy and Rory storyline and we only see bits and pieces, and it's okay not to know about Mel's. And you sort of did it as a parallel to
Wilf. Yeah.
But I see it a bit differently, because we have Donna for an episode, and then we have Wilf for an episode, and then they're both in it together.
Yeah.
And it's not like we have a whole season of Donna without Wilf being mentioned.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And so if they'd mentioned Mel's in a piece of dialogue back in season 5 at some point, just something between Amy and Rory, I really would have paid it off. Mm. Whereas in this season, I feel that, to me, it comes across like I'm desperately trying to rescue the whole plot that I've set up to make it more palatable for people, you know, or some quirky trick. So for me, it just doesn't pay off the same way. But you were also talking about in that episode about the test selector, which I didn't like the first time through, because, again, I just thought it was a get out of jail free card, and we're just introducing it in this episode because we have to. Would it be better to introduce it previously and seed that sort of thing? But I'm now completely, I've done a 180 on that, because I think if you'd seeded it like the previous season, then people would have just said, oh, yeah, he's going to use that. Whereas Stephen putting it in that episode, like, it actually is a good thing, you know, I think. But it happens too much this season where it's sort of like we need the gangers so they're in that episode to explain what's happening to Amy, and we need Mel's to explain that, and we need the test selector. So it's just the same trick for me happening in the same episodes. But it was really good listening to your points of view.
Well, you see, I think this is clearly the most complex and ambitious arc that the show ever attempts, and it never goes back again. And you can see Moffat reacting against it next year with Series 7, where it's a series of movies that have no sort of linked arc. And that's not quite true. There are character arcs in Series 7, but nevertheless, he doesn't ever do this again. And having each episode somehow contribute to the arc while not being an arc story, like The Gangers, for instance, which we didn't think was very successful but introduces an important concept, I think that's actually quite good. And I don't think the arc is as complex as everyone says either. I think it is reasonably straightforward. Is that right?
I think it's pretty straightforward, but you can see the parts moving with it. It doesn't mesh to the rest of the season all that well. So we keep returning to it to reiterate it, because it doesn't feel organic to the rest of the story. It's like it's been imposed on top of the season. And so you've got banner episodes which do deal with it. And on the episodes which don't, you keep having to jimmy it in with kind of scenes in the TARDIS where they'll talk about Amy's pregnancy or the fact that the doctor died and he doesn't know. So it just feels like it's a little bit of hard work. Not much, but a little bit.
Yeah. I think he kind of is anxious about the arc. And so that's why we it's really racist. because
the arc, not me.
It's like he keeps having these scenes which are just completely unnecessary. And I think I have a sort of shrieking fit earlier on this season on FDE where I complain that an episode begins with exactly the same scene that had ended the previous episode with Rory and Amy talking about the doctor being dead. And it's kind of like, come on, you know.
It's fireside chat by that stage of the season, isn't it?
Yeah, but you can always do it previously on Doctor Who. Like, you don't have to give us this stuff over and over again.
I think that's the brake and accelerator feeling we have with this season. It's so contemporaneous. It felt so fresh at the time, and it is. And the way it's filmed and the way it's performed, everything about the production values is so now then. Mm. But the concepts are actually Hugo Gernsback, apart from the phantom pregnancy thing, which is maybe a bit more Ray Bradbury. But they're all 40s, 50s tropes.
Ah. Ding.
They really are. All those things, the gangers, the robot monster man, these are pulp fiction 30s, 40s, golden age ideas. There's nothing really bling in this. And maybe that actually helps, because if they had been proper meta current SF, as you're getting in short stories and, you know, as you've been getting in SF writing now for 30 years, I don't think you'd keep the audience. Oh, we're up to Flux.
Well, I mean, the thing is that neither Moffat nor Davies are really interested in science fiction.
I don't think they're SF folk, are they?
No.
No, I don't think Stephen Moffat is. ITD would probably dabble in the... It's now so esoteric and speculative, and it's been so gender fluid, actually, for at least two decades, that really the only current SF that I've been getting in Doctor Who really since the 70s is the Jodie season now.
Mm.
But that's getting ahead of ourselves, isn't it?
Way ahead.
Yeah, but no, I think that maybe there's a certain comfort level in this. If they hadn't done the pregnancy thing, what do you think? If they hadn't done that, everyone would have felt a little, well, not just a little, it would have fitted better. It would have, it might have been a bit more trad. But if you're going to go way out there, be careful where you go.
Yeah, I think I observed that when I heard Amy was pregnant, when she tells the doctor in that opening two-parter, it's in the first episode, isn't it, that I thought that this is something a show would be unlikely to be able to actually deal with, and guess what? You know?
Do you think it's a failure, or do you think it is just a misstep? Or
so remember that Moffat doesn't mind being cruel to his characters because they're fictional. Right. So no person was harmed in the making of this episode. So he does terrible things to Bill. He does terrible things to Clara. He does terrible things to Amy. But I just think the pregnancy thing was a lapse in taste. I think that's the problem.
There's an ick factor to it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of... There is something about a heterosexual man watching their partner be pregnant that sometimes people find alienating. You know, like your wife is going through this thing that you're external to, and it's all kind of – it's like – she's put in a tube and, you know, kind of experimented on. Like, it's weird. And I just think some of that stuff is leaking into the show. There's a kind of ickiness about pregnancy that's being expressed here, which I just think is unfortunate.
Can you not use words like leaking and expressing? Yeah, there is an ick factor. And I think it permeates the rest of the season as well, because this season, while I'm at pains to say it is still pretty good in a lot of places, it lacks the fun, light touch that last year had. So it feels like some of the fun has been drained out of it. And that affects a whole lot of different things. It affects the storytelling. It affects the performances of the leads, I think, who are still giving immaculate performances, but just not quite as much of a light touch as they had last year.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, last year's plot was all about Amy fleeing her wedding in order to have fun with her imaginary friend. And so there is a sort of huge lightness about it, and it's about childhood and all of that sort of thing. Now it becomes sort of miserably about adulthood in, you know, a sort of Buffy series 6 kind of way. And it just is sort of slightly unpleasant. And I do think that scene where Amy's baby collapses into a pile of sick, you know, maybe that seemed better on the page. But once you see Karen Gillan reacting to it in a way that, you know, a classic series actor would not have.
I'm seeing Nicola Bryant setting fire to the studio.
I mean, Nicola Bryant, again, has the same problem, doesn't she, in Caves
She's
of Androzani?
She's too good.
And I think Karen is too good for that scene, and so the distress is too real. And even though it's a sort of science fiction thing that could never happen, her reaction brings such reality to
it. It's too close to every viewer who's a couple or a single or a person who's had a miscarriage. It's just too damn close.
Yeah, yeah.
So that sort of leads to a question here from one of our listeners, Fluxer Gregory, champion of the damned at Felix Fraser, has this to say: what three things, and it can be anything from behind the scenes to what was broadcast, would you change about this series? So it sounds like the whole pregnancy storyline is certainly one thing that we would consider.
Yeah.
Could you have kept the pregnancy though? And you see, this is the sad thing, is it's one of the current missing episodes, and that I do remember seeing it a very long time ago, this story that we're talking about, but I actually have no real recollection of how it hangs together. And I just feel that if we, you know, maybe we could do a reconstruction of it and sort of rewrite it. I'm told the Celestial Toymaker is a great story too.
The massacre.
Go back and see it. Yes. Well, yes. No, I pregnancy is not, you know, the giving of life or the most emotional experience that you can possibly go through is not something that we should divert ourselves from, but we should tackle it with, as you said, with taste.
Mm. But I think that's also the pressures of the time of the writing, you know, when you're under the hammer to get things out. You know, I think Stephen in the past, when he's been in the Russell T era, he's had time to reflect and polish. And here it's sort of like, here's my first or second draft. I can't take a step back because I've got to deal with other things.
Yeah.
You know, and so he has the ability to still deliver really interesting dialogue and complex stories, but you don't have time to replace scripts, or you don't. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And we said last season as well, one of the problems that Stephen faces is that he doesn't have a Stephen. He doesn't have another reliable writer who's delivering something every season.
to give him that sort of little break.
That little respite. Yeah.
Well, we can look in the past. What would Terence Dix have done? I mean, whether it be Liz Shaw or Romani, you just boot him out at the first sign of getting up there. Or in Paul Victoria's case, toss her to the seaweed.
Or you hire Bob Baker and Dave Martin and all your problems are solved.
Oh.
Not anymore.
No, you couldn't hire him now.
No.
No. I like the idea that Amy is River Song's mother. And
yeah, I like that. Yeah.
And I like her getting to take revenge on Madame Kavarain in the finale.
I think it's great scenes.
So good.
Wedding of River Song is actually much better than people think it is.
Oh, yeah,
much
yeah.
Much better than we remember, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, we were really positive about it last
week.
Oh,
I haven't heard that podcast yet. Yeah, it's good. It's good.
Yeah.
Interrupting you with another question from one of our listeners, Simon Hart says this: it's been a series of highs and lows, but which story do you think rise so high and which one fell so low? And I think the Wedding of River Song for me is the episode that actually rised so high.
Yeah.
I agree too.
I liked it more than I expected. I liked Let's Kill Hitler more than I expected, even though I think that there's some scenes that I don't enjoy watching towards the end of it. I think that Night Terrors has very little to recommend it. And I think Curse of the Black Spot is much worse than I remember. And it's because of those goddamn space corridors. It promises pirates and just gives us the most dingy, low-effort space corridors imaginable. It's miserable.
Your first attempt at interpretive theatre in the school gym.
Yeah.
If only they'd shot it at the paper mill.
Richard, do you... highs and lows, which rise so high, which
original. I want to be original, but nah. Exactly what you said. My low is still Let's Kill Hitler, because I cannot escape that which Mr. Moffat should have considered. I don't know. I want to come back to that. I agree with Nathan. But what would you have done with the pregnancy arc, Peter and Todd? What would you have written instead? Would you have had the baby at all? Well, I know you can't because your insides are all wrong, but what would you...
Well, considering that the plot line is River Song is going to be her child, there is no escaping that, really,
is there?
Well, I mean, you could have her not pregnant and still discover that later on she gets pregnant and has... Because it's also the abduction of the baby as well.
That's right. The thing that I find uncomfortable is kind of the forced birther aspect of the whole thing. That's quite
tricky. So maybe more in a Girl Who Waited universe, she could have had the child and perhaps there would have been something. There could have been a gentler way of doing it.
I think that he does make attempts to fix it, and they work on a story kind of level, on a fictional level. But if you're watching this imagining real people going through it, then it's absolutely unsatisfactory. The fact that, you know, she's a little girl dying of tuberculosis or something in New York at the end of episode two, like, it's miserable. It's terrible.
And then she's got to get herself across to England many years later. And I assume that she would have regenerated into an adult and then regenerated back into a small child so she could then live as Mel's.
Yeah, that's right. She is a small child, isn't she? We do see flashback Mel's in...
sort of like Matt Smith Capaldi in reverse.
What about you, Peter? Like, are there any stories that you think rose so high or... anything that fell down for you?
I think the God Complex is clearly the best episode of the season, not because of what it's attempting, but just because it's a really good, old-fashioned, traditional, excellent story, which is really well made. And we're a bit short on those this season. What I would change, and going back to our previous reader's question as well about three things you change about the season, all three of mine would be the Gangers two-parter. It's just this big, mushy, Gangers shaped hole in the middle of the season. Did we ever find out if they have those, by the way?
I'm crossing my legs. We got to cover that, didn't we, Peter? We've been in that, sort of in that congee
soup, yeah,
that narrative congee. Yes, it didn't work. There's a lot of failures in this season to equal the high points. Yeah.
It's that thing where people say, oh, I don't like the arc episodes, but I do like the individual episodes. And you kind of go, well, what have you got? You know, Girl Who Waited and God Complex. The other individual,
the Doctor's Wife. Yeah.
But the others are not that great, I think.
Yeah, I kind of think last year those episodes were like above the seven area for me, whereas this year they're falling below that, right? And so it's just a dip. And I don't like the Gangers stuff. I would change that. I think that Let's Kill Hitler has Matt's worst performance as the Doctor.
Yep.
Where he
There's
has
so
do,
much being asked of him.
Yeah.
But that whole dying sequence with the cane and all of that on the floor, it just doesn't work for me. It just
no.
That is the nadir of his performance as the Doctor. And I think he's absolutely brilliant. And that on top of my dislike of the whole Mel storyline. But I do like all the Tesselecta stuff and that sort of thing. It just doesn't work for me. The Gangers doesn't work for me. Although I like a lot of Good Man Goes to War, it's ruined by stuff at the end. And then we head into Night Terrors, which is just like I just wanted to turn it off.
Poor Night Terrors.
But for me, the story that really did come up, in my opinion, was The Wedding of the Song. And that sort of rescued a lot of the whole arc. And I found that really surprising, you know.
He's so clever, he does pull it together.
Yeah, yeah. And it's great too because we're used to the big, dumb, explosive finale. And this one deals with the arc as a kind of throwaway gag at the end of the episode. It's really, there's a lightness of touch to it because we've already had the Doctor dying in episode one and it's all overwrought and you've got, you know, again, Karen's reaction to it really selling it. And so to have it a joke at the end, like, it's fun. Yeah.
And it feels like the first fun that Stephen's had this season. I said last season that I would be interested to see Stephen Moffat fail. And that's not because I wanted him to produce a bad episode, but I thought he's been so consistently brilliant up until this point that I wanted to see an episode where he doesn't quite make it work and how interesting that would be. And all of his episodes this season, I include the opening two-parter in this, but certainly A Good Man Goes to War and Let's Kill Hitler, he doesn't quite make it work, even though all of the episodes are packed with interest and cleverness. And yet by The Wedding of River Song, I think he has made it work. He has that lightness of touch back.
I was going to ask you, Peter, like about Stephen Moffat failures, because that was something on my list. Like, you know, how do you feel about his failures this season?
I mean, you'd rather watch a Stephen Moffat failure over Curse of the Black Spot any day.
Oh, yeah.
Any
I agree.
Day at all. And it's just, it's the inverse of last season, where last season you looked forward to every arc episode because you knew that Stephen Moffat was going to be writing it and it was invariably going to be great.
Yeah.
Whereas this season, as we said, some of the single episodes are the best episodes. And so it feels a little bit topsy-turvy.
Hmm. I find that I like The Girl Who Waited a lot more than I expected. And it was a little bit like Amy's Choice last year, where I just sort of thought it's sort of very high concept and very Star Trek and stuff like that. And I wasn't sort of super into it, but I do think that the girl who weighs it is so lifted by Nick Hurren,
yes,
that it is one of the best episodes of the series.
It's one of the very few Doctor Who episodes where you can tangibly see the input of the director and how he has raised the material, which is already good.
Well, I think the God Complex is the same.
Yep.
Yeah.
I like Girl Who Waited this time around because we get to see how good Karen is.
Yeah.
And I'd forgotten that first time around. I was conflating, you know, the narrative with the actor, but now I can see she really convinced me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Richard, like, we're on the same wavelength because I've said it 1,000 times now. Like, I really didn't like Karen the first time through. And looking at things now, it's more a case of the character of Amy at times rather than actually Karen, whose performances I think really do elevate stuff. And I really like her so much more in so many episodes this season. And the Madame Kavarian scene is just like the pinnacle of all of those things. But I'm not going to discount, like, I think Arthur Darvill is the unsung hero of so many things. He's just there all the time. And I think his performances are spot on. And I really, really adore him. So I'm just going to talk about the three who, you know, and of course, Matt is, I just think stunning. And this team are really, really strong. And it's a shame in a – I was going to say it's a shame in a way, but it's sort of like Stephen doesn't want to let them go.
No.
And I think narratively the whole exit of Amy and Rory towards the end of the season and then the Doctor revisiting them in closing time and then seeing them in the Christmas special as We Leave a Place for You, and the fact that, you know, they know that he's alive because River has told her parents – to me, it's sort of like it could be a nice place to leave them as a positive, like, you know, that our friend the Doctor's still out there and he will still visit us, but we will move on with our lives. We can let go of my imaginary friend, but we have to come back next year and we have to have a different ending and it has to not be all
good.
Or happy families, do you know what I mean? You've already touched on the fact what will happen to other companions. It's like Stephen can give his companions no joy. Nobody, and maybe Russell set it up a bit too, is that, you know, you travel with the Doctor and it's all going to end not in a happy place. And it's sort of like, I would really like that to happen, you know. I really do like the fact that the Doctor lets Amy and Rory go to an extent and we see them again in closing time. I really do like that. And if that was all we saw of them in the end, like in the Christmas special, then I would be really, really happy with their arc.
Yeah.
And that scene at the end of the God Complex is fantastic.
It's really, really good. Yeah. Yeah, it's a great companion departure. I think that Russell does have the idea that the companion should be better off having travelled with the Doctor. Rose's family gets fixed and they're wealthy and her dad is back. Martha has been through something, but she's a strong person and is deciding to leave on her own terms and look after her family. And I guess we feel bad because Donna's sort of robbed of that, but we still see that she's marrying someone nice who, and they're going to win the lottery and all of that sort of thing. So they're kind of going to be better off.
That's very true. There is positives in Russell's. There are some negatives as well, getting to that point.
Yeah, yeah. But Moffat doesn't do that. No, you know, like, two of the companions become the Doctor or are dead and become the Doctor. And then Amy and Rory are trapped somewhere miserable with no Wi-Fi for the rest of their lives. I just think it's terrible.
Rose says it, doesn't she, in Parting of the Ways. She says, the Doctor shows you a better way of living your life.
Yeah.
And no one can make that claim for Amy and Rory or Clara, you know.
Closing Time is another one that I was a bit down on previously. And I actually like it as a nice little light story at the end of the season. I don't think it's as good as the episode last year.
Yeah, it needed a Leela, didn't it? It would have been over in 7 minutes.
But we do get the Cybermats.
Yeah.
Isn't that good?
Love the cyber thingies. Yeah.
Do you know what I really would have liked in that episode?
What?
I would have liked a sequel where James Corden, even though I think he's very good in The Lodger, leaves at the start and the Doctor has the episode with
Daisy Haggard.
Daisy Haggard.
And Stormageddon.
Absolutely, with Stormageddon.
Does get a bit boys club. I can see why, because we're showing a gormless boy who is, you know, has never really managed his life.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of confidence issues, and therefore he's the fanboy of many who's watching it. I'm not going to use the word I always use. But
two men and a baby, isn't it?
Exactly, that kind of thing. And I think I'd rather have Daisy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stephen could have written a sequel. How about Two Men and a Goo Baby with the Doctor and Rory and the Goo Baby and the TARDIS? That would be amazing. Oh, no, it's splattered on the floor. Amy.
I think that was written from Stephen having to deal with children's, you know, yeah. if you've ever vomited on exactly that milky flow,
La Croix baby spew.
Yes.
La Croix, yes. Baby spew.
Yes.
So speaking of which, snog, marry, avoid. The Silence, the Gangers, the Test Selector.
Well, I think you marry the Tesselector because...
Ouch, though. It's still got hard edges.
Well, I don't know. You know, like one day he's Tom Hardy. You know, one day he's Nandor from What We Do in the Shadows. I can see it.
Preset
Nandor. One day he's a Grorian from Blake 7.
Absolutely. Oh, wait. Am I snogging or marrying him? I'm marrying him and then repeatedly snogging him. I would snog the Silence because however horrific it is, I wouldn't remember it when I turned away.
We've all been to conventions in our youth.
That's right. That's what alcohol's for. And what's the other one? The Gangers. I'd avoid the Gangers because they're in a terrible two-part story.
I think I'd have to marry the Silence because that would be amazing. You come home after a busy day and not have to say anything. Blessed silence.
DJ Alpha T, Scarfunk Soul Beats, asks this. Do you think there was anything left unresolved? I always thought the Silence tunnels under the earth were a dangling plot point. And was the revelation as to what the Silence are in The Day of the Doctor a misstep? Well, we won't talk about that last bit till we get there.
Yeah.
But at this point, were there any points left unsolved? And, of course, the tunnels under the earth was a dangling plot point. Well, you know the Tractators could have used them.
Exactly. Leaves us open for another Tractator invasion.
Another visit to Kolkakron.
My favourite planet.
Maybe Madame Kavarian? Because, like, although she's killed in the, well, left to die in the alternative timeline, we never do see her again, do we?
No, but I think she's dead because we saw her dead on telly. You know, Stephen brings characters back when they're dead because he doesn't care because he knows it's all made up. But I think having seen her die and kind of plead for mercy and stuff is so great. I'm just saying that happened, even if the alternate timeline gets erased or whatever, she's totally dead. I think that the Silence, and I think we said it at the time, it is that thing where suddenly the Silence have been with us because, did I say it's like Scaroth's day off or the Fendal's day off, you know, influencing human history and evolution. And there's no way to square that with anything else that's ever happened in Doctor Who. But I kind of don't care. So, yes, there's tunnels under the earth and we're all repeatedly, this is the thing, that we keep running across Silence in our everyday lives and we kill them and then we forget about it. And we've all done it. Todd's killed bunches of them.
Oh, yes. You know how I like the odd genocide.
I do like that idea, though, that at points in human history, Theo Ransom and the Silence are facing off over who's going to influence what bit.
That's right. And Scaros, they're going, I invented the wheel. I invented the wheel.
I still want to know how the Botswain got taken to that horrible space corridor ship with the AI.
Yeah.
That's my plot point.
Yeah, well, that's the scene where Lee Ross gets just edited out by mistake and disappears. And it is a massive flaw in that episode. Like, it's a kind of act of incompetence that I think we've rarely seen in the new series.
Up to this point.
Yeah.
It's something about the grammar of television that just doesn't no. doesn't happen and yet does in that episode. And so it leaves you feeling a little bit uneasy about kind of the decisions that are being made and how much focus is being put on things.
Yeah.
All right. Blaine Coughlin asks this, given that the climax of A Good Man Goes to War is more revelation than actual cliffhanger, would the Almost people have provided a more shocking mid-season finale?
I don't think you can go to a mid-season break with Amy collapsing into goo. It's just too traumatic.
And that cliffhanger is horrible because then she wakes up in the tube.
Yeah.
I just don't want to have that unresolved for 6 weeks, I think. It would have been more shocking. I'm a big fan of the cliffhanger that's a revelation or a, you know, what are we going to do next, rather than just sort of straightforward peril, I think. And so I like that. You know, the Doctor is searching for Melody during the mid-season break. You know, the Doctor goes off with a mission and then we check in on his mission, and it's been months since we've watched the show and we imagine the Doctor on that quest during that time.
See, that's interesting because, like, I wanted to see that quest.
Mm-hmm.
That's the things I want to see.
Yeah.
When we have time jumps where we're suddenly at a point further along the track, it all just seems so simple. And certainly with the Cybermen just being relegated to a scene, right, and getting to that point would have been quite difficult, but it makes it just seem so easy to defeat them, you know, with big explosions and everything like that. So part of my dislike of that whole plot thing is that I would have liked to have seen peril and deadly danger for the Doctor and Rory as a team to find out where his companion and his wife are, you know, and I think that would have paid off for me so much more. But that's obvious, you know, that's not the narrative that modern television necessarily or Stephen wants to go in. But for me, that's one of the changes that I would have liked, you know. And yes, Amy may not have been around, but even if we'd had a two-parter and you know, something to do with, say, Vastra, Strax and Jenny and seeing an introduction to how they actually met the Doctor and that sort of thing, rather than, I mean, it's great that they've been introduced and their characters, like Stephen likes introducing these characters, oh, yes, with potential and we're going to see them again and they're my playthings of Stephen for a little while, you know, but that's what I would have liked to have seen.
Yeah.
That would have been a more traditional arc if we'd seen that kind of quest storyline. And Stephen's not interested in telling that this season, is he?
No. And I think, too, that he is happy to just let us infer backstory. I mean, there's a introduction to her somewhere buried on a DVD box set or something? Anyway, I think there is some kind of backstory somewhere, but it's not what he's interested in. The characters are here, you know, whatever, I think. And I think that's okay. It's just that we want to be able to write our TARDIS Wikia entry for them, and he deliberately frustrates us at every point, I think.
It's like the character of Lorna Bucket in A Good Man Goes to War, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah, she's kind of like, she's there and she has backstory with him and she's actually not a very well-developed character, and so she's part of the disappointment of that episode because her death is built up to mean something and doesn't actually mean something. So maybe that's the story of this season, where things are built up to mean something and don't quite hit.
Lorna with an L.
Now, speaking of which, Snog, marry, avoid. Lorna Bucket. Val.
Okay.
Val and, or Joy.
Kind of like the idea of just getting them all together for a very exciting stock take after the doors, after the shops all closed. Linda would say, oh, I've just got some little tea cakes, and just brings out this huge 2-litre bottle of duty-free gin. And Joy would always clean up after herself, always, even if she's made her own mess by scattering her body parts all over the room. She would still be kind enough and thoughtful enough. And then the other one was Val. I have no memory of these women. Are you sure? These are the missing episodes. I think we could have a lot of cheeky fun and there'd be Cybermat. So, you know, there'd be a chase. There'd be fun. It'd be like, you know, like a paper. No, I think we could all have a lot of fun in the room together. Yeah. Look, their hips would give way. You couldn't even get near to them to snog them, let alone.
What do you think of Stephen's treatment of gay characters this season? in terms of having Canton, and then we've got the thin one
and the fat one.
It's all treated the as big, fat, an extraordinary revelation. Sorry, Peter.
Is it the big, fat, boring gaze?
We're right here, aren't we?
I'm feeling really attacked right now.
I don't like how he throws it in as, oh, look, we're throwing in a surprise, and look how shocking and surprising this is. Tonally, or at least in the way it's structured in the story, using it as the startling revelation, it may not be that great a way to introduce a queer character, and he does it not just the once. Could forgive it if it was maybe just the once. Oh, look, they're gay. Okay. Yeah, and the point is,
I actually don't mind the revelation that Canton is gay, because we like him and we've seen him work with the Doctor and he's funny and stuff. So we're disposed to like him, and then we discover he's gay. And then we get Richard Nixon pulling the comedy face as well, which I just think is really hilarious.
That actor is superb.
Yeah.
Yes. He is superb. Yeah.
So I kind of like that, because it also just kind of shows how unpleasant Nixon is as well. Like, it challenges Nixon.
It actually gets really accurate. We talked about this. It's actually really accurate to what we now know Nixon was like as a human being.
Yeah.
And if he wasn't, I don't want to use medical terms, but he was so dissociated from human involvement and understanding of human relations and emotions that that he actually said to, this was before Watergate, he said to one of the cameramen, did you enjoy a consummation this weekend? did you enjoy your relationship? It was actually used a word even more vulgar than that, but it was very clinical. And he really didn't understand the connection between it was all very meta for Mr. Nixon.
Well, he had been driven mad by the constant presence of the silence. Yeah. And I kind of like that. They kind of reify his paranoia.
They do, don't they?
And the constant phone calls at all hours from little girls.
And then the other one is the fat one and the thin one. And the fat one gets killed. And also,
are we doing Bond finger?
And
diamonds are forever.
Yes, that's right. And I just think, again, he has no idea about the church at all, and, you know, doesn't realize the Anglican Church is populated by fat and thin gay people who are married to one another, and it's not absolutely that unusual. So I don't know. He's not very good at it. He's trying. There were no queer people in Series 5 at all. Yeah. So he has at least nodded in our direction. And we didn't mention Jenny and Vastra as well. Yeah. Yeah.
I also like the constant mistaking of the Doctor and Craig as a gay couple, because it's done with charm.
Yeah.
It's
done
with warmth, and it's sort of seen through Val's eyes as being something that's really nice. So I like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that one did work. He got it right by the end. Yeah.
Also, too, those last two episodes, there is that joy coming back. Like, there's a weight getting lifted after all of this, which is great at the end of the season, which is, again, going back to why I think I really do like that little run at the end.
Yeah.
The joy is coming back.
I must have missed joy coming back. She unexploded in the corner of the toilet.
All right, Snog, Marry, Avoid. Captain Avery, Idris, House.
Idris is too bitey, no snogging.
No, it's like snogging only someone wins. Well, obviously, Captain Avery.
Yeah, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, no, he's really hot.
He seems to floss too, which is a comfort in those times.
He has very good teeth for the 17th century or whatever we are, the 16th century.
It does come with baggage though.
But he loses it very quickly. He doesn't seem to be able to hold on to any family members for very length of time. So
making up for Downton Abbey.
Yeah. His own personal life, which we're not going to go into.
And what about House? House is Michael Sheen. He's he's lovely. And sinister, but
he can do a Kenneth Williams, so you won't be bored.
No, I could marry him. Leave somewhere to live.
I don't think he'd last long. Not in your current form, anyway.
No, well, there's that. Yeah, and avoid Idris because of the biting.
I wonder how we'd go if these questions were about the writers.
Let's not do that.
No, we won't go there. But I do want to ask this question. What do you think of the oldest question hidden in plain sight?
Well,
Revelation.
Old since 1963.
Yeah, it's in the opening credits of the first episode. It's the first question. That's what it means, hidden in plain sight. It's right there.
Well, fortunately, Chibbers has solved it all.
Yeah,
for
he's
us.
Going to answer it.
Okay. How did you feel about that? That's a good question. How did you feel about that as the season finale, as the last, and that lovely shot of Matt with the TARDIS behind him?
I was so excited. Like, I actually felt an adrenaline rush. It's sort of like we're going back to how it all began, where the Doctor's not known. It's all going to be fresh and new, and I just really love the referencing of that, you know?
If only we knew that Stephen didn't police punches, because he keeps trying to reset the series to this and then fails when he comes up with his next brilliant idea.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, I think that the acknowledgement that the Doctor is famous is reasonable given that he's actually famous in the real world. And the idea that he's a terrible threat, again, you know, there's been hundreds of stories where he's blown people up and all of that kind of thing. And so making that part of the narrative, behaving as if that's actually really happened, you know, kind of interrogating the premise.
The entire population of Devesham is still experiencing afterglow, aren't they?
That's right. And so, you know, like, I think it's unavoidable. And the classic series, I think, does the Doctor is famous every so often, but doesn't do the sort of he's a deadly threat to everyone in the entire universe.
Although Tom in his last season or two.
Yeah. I have to take him to a whole other universe where no one knows who he is.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the time the Doctor is literally saving the universe, he's got to have some level of fame.
Yeah.
In a season of many different guest stars, is there anybody that stands out for you in terms of performance or character? I mean, there's so many, from Hugh Bonneville to Saran Jones. I think Amara Kara, who plays Rita, as a potential companion, I think is
very good.
Oh, I think she's easily the best guest actor in the entire thing. I think she's absolutely extraordinary. So good. So incredibly good.
She brings that character to absolute life. And also, I think Dimitri Leonidas, who plays Howie, is another, maybe slightly lesser example, because Amara Khan is fantastic. But he also does sterling work with bringing that character to life in the God Complex. It's a reason why I really like that episode, because it has a number of really well-drawn, interesting characters played well. And you can't say that for every episode this season.
David Walliams, as Gibbous, I think, does a really good job of that character. Like, I mean, asking somebody to play under all that makeup too, you know, as a guest artist, I think it's really good that he did that, you know. I think a lot of people would have turned it down based on that fact.
I don't think David Walliams would have turned a role in Doctor Who down. No. I think he's a big, giant nerd. And then, obviously, Matt Lucas gets to outdo
it. That's right. I think part of Russell's upcoming master plan will be a Gibbous and Nardol spin-off. Maybe.
Rita needed to credibly be a possible companion for the episode to work. The episode is kind of about that. And
yeah, it's a companion harvester, isn't it?
Yeah. She's so good. Holy crap. She's unbelievably great.
Some of us were disappointed he didn't take the Minotaur.
Yes. Well,
some of us have been disappointed with that since the Time Monster.
Well, what you mean? I didn't get to do the voice in that one either.
My new companion, Dave Prowse. So I don't know whether I'm using my voice for Darth Vader.
All right, we've got a couple of award nominations, as we always do. Do we have any Jenny Laird Award nominations this year?
Yeah, mine goes to Stephen Moffat, and it is for thinking that the pregnancy thing would work in Doctor Who.
going, yeah, we're all thinking the same thing. That's the major, that's the summit. That's the thing everyone's looking at. Thinking it's frosty up there, isn't it? Don't want to go up there. No, it's littered and scattered with things you don't want to encounter. I agree. Yeah. And then there's some poor creative choices of just the unevenness of the script. I think the reason, though, that stories like Night Terrors and what are the other ones we didn't like so much just keeps coming back to me is Night
Curse
Terrors.
Curse of the Congees.
Yeah. It's simply that in a traditional season, say if you put this in season 15, they'd probably stood out. It's just that we're getting such highs and lows and that the expectations and production values and all the rest of it and the rapidity and wit in the scripts, there's a lot more density dramatically now.
And I think you've hit the nail on the head. The expectation. We had series 4, which really
incredible.
And then we had series 5, which again, and so you just keep expecting that every year you're going to hit the mark. And that doesn't happen. That's not reality. You just can't keep that sustainability at that level all the time. And if we don't meet those expectations, then you kind of are down on something. Like I've said for quite a long time that this is probably my least liked Stephen Moffat series.
I agree.
I don't know whether that's going to be the case. I see so many more positives, but there are certain minefields to get through in this season.
And as we said earlier, there are some really great bits as well, like Doctor's Wife, Girl Who Waited, The God Complex, but the good bits don't come where you expect that they will.
Yeah, we're not meeting those expectations. Any other nominations?
I would nominate the whole of The Gangers just because already it's quite a problematic, bland script, not really dealing well with the issues which it's trying to deal with. And then overlaid on that, I think the direction misses. And then on top of that, they drain the color out of it all, so it's difficult to watch.
Yeah.
So it's just a whole big mess of bad Jenny Laird choices.
In fact, maybe Jenny Laird Award can go to the terrible lighting in the first half of the series from Impossible Astronaut all the way through to the end of The Gangers two-part. It's turn the goddamn lights on someone.
It might actually be post because I'm thinking back to film at the time too. When I did animation, which is now 20 years ago, the folk that ended up doing the best out of that and are still getting paid the highest are the folk that do the digital grading, the compositors end of it. And the fashion at the time, you think about films around this time 10, 11 years ago, everything was freaking drained and almost sepia, so fashionable and chic.
And
it's annoying, I agree. It's annoying.
But it's interesting you're talking about the Gangers episodes, which I haven't really commented on and now feel the need, I really dislike Jen as a character and I really dislike the CGI when she becomes a monster. It just builds for me. But Nathan, you did talk about Cleve's journey and it's something that has made me sort of reevaluate that aspect of the story. There is a glimmer in there because in my notes, looking back on it, it was something that I did comment about, like to not as articulated as what you did in the episode, but it's something that I did notice there was more to that where I just sort of tarnished the whole thing with that one horrible brush. But nothing can save those two episodes for me. The whole baby goo thing, the whole Mel's into River and the appalling performance sequence with Matt Smith in that episode. Like those things are just front and center in my mind. But I've got to take myself out of that because there is so much to really like in this season.
That said, though, you can always find things that you'll enjoy even in the bits that you don't. So when Matt comes out of the TARDIS to do that prolonged dying scene, which is asking far too much of any actor, he is dressed as Marlena Dietrich. And, of course, if you're going to come out of the TARDIS and do your big turn in pre-war Germany, that's what you're going to look like.
He's not doing Fred Astaire. He's doing Von Sternberg's Blue Angel. You're right. He is a thief. Watch the boys in the back room. They'll have.
You'd appreciate Von that, Richard.
I've got a trick hip. Yes. There's a lot that needs rescuing in this season.
But on the flip side is the Bonnie Langford. A startling discovery. Is there...
Nick Horan, sorry, I've stolen everyone else's.
Yeah, I think absolutely. And you remember my reaction to The Leisure Hive, which is a story that is experimental visually and just so much better and more interesting than what's come before. I think Nick Hurren does that with The God Complex.
Yeah.
Yes, I think that's a really good nomination. Mine is for Karen Gillan's hair. Because she has wonderful hair throughout this entire season. And I think that then affects the subtlety in her performance as well. I think it just adds to that. I just like her hair. Like, I mean, it's all about the hair for me. Like, if you talk about Sarah Jane Smith, I think Sarah Jane's hair in season 13 is the perfect length, right?
Yeah.
And so Sarah goes through different phases from short, medium, long, and extra long right at the end, but she has this golden patch. And so for me, with Karen's hair, it's sort of like this is the revelation about how good she is.
You also like Dodo's hair?
Just stop it. This is why I've avoided doing episodes with you for the entire year.
It has to be said that Karen does have magical hair, because even when she's aged 36 years, it still has that beautiful auburn tone to it.
Yeah. Well, they dull the red down, which, as we know, happens in real life for most of us as well.
Yes.
So I was a lovely, almost virtual Titian. I was never that light. But, it drained. Life, like cinematography, tends to drain the colour out of us the longer the season we go.
Like the gangers.
The gangers, yes. It's a good point if we just come back to that, because actors do give a stronger or more cohesive performance if they feel confident in the role. And as P.G. Woodhouse and Bo Brummel both said, if you put a good suit on them, put a good boiler on them, you're going to get a better show. Clothes maketh man. Yeah, I think there might be something to that.
So finally, looking to the future, I always ask, where does series 7A/7B sit with you before we embark on that journey?
I think there's some good stuff in it in both halves. I don't like, we've talked about this before possibly, I don't like the way that Amy and Rory leave at all. But I think they're sort of fun to be had. I actually miss the complexity a bit. But it's nice to try new things. And, you know, I think there are some reasonably entertaining things in there. So I'm kind of looking forward to it.
Peter?
I'm definitely looking forward to Series 7A because I think it regains some of the fun that's been a bit diminished this season. And I think it's a series of very strong episodes. I haven't seen them in a long time, so I may revise this opinion, but I think it's a series of strong episodes. And I wouldn't have thought that I'd said that about a mini season with two Chibnall episodes, but there we go.
Yeah.
Richard?
And I'm really looking forward to seeing what comes next, because I haven't watched them since they first went out. My memory is very dim. I'm glad to hear they're not amongst the lost episodes, and so we will be able to see them and review them next year. Really no memory at all. is there a giant squid in it and seven sexy rituals?
Nearly.
And a methane extractor, I believe. Conflating that. Yeah, no, I have no memory. And I like doing these. I don't know if you've been doing them the same way. I know Nathan hasn't, but not watching them until we're going to do the stories. And then you go, and that's when, like Todd, my opinions have been really revised to the point that it's just a flip, just a pancake flip. Like, oh, I hated her. I don't quite like her now.
Yeah, for me, I'm very much like you, Peter. I really think that that set of five episodes at the beginning of next season is quite strong consistently. And I'm with Nathan, the writing out of Amy and Rory is problematic. In terms of Clara, like, I really think that I really love Jenna Coleman in the first episode and in the Christmas, that those versions of Clara. After that, well, I still think she's a great actress, but am I going to find that I find the second half of the season much more forgettable? Although I will say this, that there is one episode in there which I absolutely detested beyond all imagining at the time.
Cold War. Hyde.
Celestial Toymaker.
And it's not Journey to the Center of the TARDIS,
Rings of Akaton.
Yeah. Which I absolutely detested at the time.
Yeah, I did too. I'm looking forward to seeing what I think about
that. But I have seen it since. And I reversed my opinion.
Yeah.
Well, dear listener, that's all we have time for this week. We'll be back at Christmas to get our Narnia on in The Doctor, the Widow, and the Wardrobe. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, at FTE Podcast on Twitter, and on our website, flightthroughentirety.com, where you'll find links to our other podcasts, Bondfinger, Jodie Into Terror, Maximum Power, and Untitled Star Trek Project. Until next time, sweetheart, I think Mummy might need another drink. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good night.
See you soon.
Chin chin.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Todd Bealby, Nathan Bottomley, Peter Griffiths, and Richard Stone. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. This episode, Playthings of Stephen, was recorded on the 28th of November 2021 and released on the 19th of December. That's the end of our Series 6 coverage, and so we'd like to thank everyone who's joined us on the couch over the last few weeks. Maxwell Coviello, Stephen and Dan from New to Who Podcast, Simon Moore, Adam Richard, Kevin Bernard, Corey McMahon, Cy Hart, Conrad Westmus, Joe Ford and Jack Shanahan.
What do you think of the child actors this season, besides Toby Avery? Oscar Lloyd is Toby Avery, who I think is a bit older.
Yeah.
And if I was to include Lily Arnell from the Christmas special at the end of the season, who I actually think is quite good, what do you think of the other assorted children?
I thought George was sweet. I really liked George.
Yeah, I thought George was sweet as well.
And I can't stand him. He's just a kid. He's just a little boy.
No, don't blink, George.
No, but I mean, clearly
no projection.
That is...
grab that pillow and smother him, Todd.
These are awful. I hate it.
He and Cyril can team up. Bloody Cyril Arnold.
What did you think of George?
I think...
I've been triggered.
Triggered.
I'm
we
so
forget
sorry.
For
we
the listener at home.
This is
I
terrible.
Hate the bit for, that you say are terrible children.
For the listener at home, we have to remember what our podcasters do for a living.
So surprising that Toby delivered such a good performance because he'd been kicked in the head by a
I'm still laughing about that because I said it, and your laughter at that point in that episode. I just keep going back to it. Oh yes, scintillating things like you know, dragged through a hedge and kicked.
It's funny, I think, because when you say it, you don't realise how funny it is. Like, and then and so you deliver it completely straight. It's really great. It's one of my favourite moments from this season of Flight Through Entirety.
I think Stephen should have come up with that. A few other child actors could have been kicking their head by a horse this season. Sorry.
Caitlin Blackwood's very good.
Yep. She is always.
In fact, the three kids in the flashbacks are great.
Oh, can I just
except
say?
For Rory, maybe.
No, that little Rory is so
he's
convincing.
Cute,
he's so convincing as a little gormless Rory.
He's too gormless. It just undermines Rory yet again. That's what I don't like about it. I just think he's such a little dweeby thing. It's sort of like, oh, please.
You're going to have to cut all this.
Oh, well, look, child actors, they're not going to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Might just damage their psyche for their entire adult lives. Who knows?
Yeah, that's right.
Perhaps. Yeah, all right.
Baby Rory's robbed a convenience store now.
That's what he's got convention appearances to look forward
to. No, I made that up. Allegedly.
All right.
Keeping all this.
Yeah. It's
old.
These are stayers. Marry this lot. Yeah.
This is the show.
Yeah, this is it. You're doomed, all of you.
All right. We've got a couple of award nominations,
mm-hmm.
as we always do. Do we have any Jenny Laird Award nominations?